This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Faneuil Hall is iconic for its role in the Revolution. Samuel Adams and the Sons of Liberty met there multiple times to discuss the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, and the Boston Tea Party. An estimated 20 million people pass through the marketplace every year. But it's also notorious for its role in the trade of enslaved people. And for that reason, some want to erase the name of the man who built and donated it to the city, Peter Faneuil. I spoke with three of those advocates back in February. These are people who have staged sit-ins in City Hall, chained themselves to Faneuil Hall, and even gone on a hunger strike. Reverend Kevin Peterson is the founder of the New Democracy Coalition. Reverend John Gibbons is the community minister for Good Trouble at the Arlington Street Church of Boston. And Valerie Copeland is pastor of the Neighborhood Church of Dorchester. I began by asking Valerie Copeland about the complexity of Faneuil Hall, that we know the full history of what happened there, but we choose to recognize only a part of that history when we visit. Valerie chuckled a little bit.
I'm going to say let's start with defining we. As an African-American person who's lived in Boston all of her life, I don't bring my visitors to Faneuil Hall because there's nothing there for them to see. When you visit Faneuil Hall, you see very few people of color. And in fact, I've had people question me when they have come, right? When they come on business or they come with their white friends, they'll often say, where are the black people, right? So there's no evidence of black community, black society, black history, black culture prevalent anywhere at Faneuil Hall.
So that's such an important point, Reverend Kevin Peterson, because if we think about the back and forth on this since, I would say, roughly 2017, when you really started to push for the change in the name at Faneuil Hall, the back and forth often is, why do you want to take away something that many can see clearly for its full truth and want as a landmark of who we are in Boston? But Valerie Copeland is saying, not even that's right. Right? Faneuil Hall is important for part of Boston, but not for all of
Boston. Well, it's not a takeaway. It's an add to, really. It's a way that we enhance our history. It's a way that we look at the past in order to examine the present and dig down into or engage what the future of Boston should look like. So when we talk about changing the name of Faneuil Hall, we're talking about engaging in deep conversations about race and racial reconciliation in Boston. It's not a symbolic move, but it's a move towards having a deeper dialogue about the structure of racism, which exists in Boston in 2023, but certainly had some of its genesis in the 1700s when Faneuil Hall was constructed. We call it Slave Traders Hall because Peter Faneuil was a white supremacist, a person who owned slaves, a bigot. And we don't believe that it's proper for our city officials and we as citizens to support the name of a publicly owned building after a person such as Peter Faneuil. So we want to change the name. It's a little complicated. We want to change the name in order to dig deeper into what we can be as a city moving forward as Boston approaches its 400th anniversary.
So a little context for listeners here. So Peter Faneuil, wealthy local businessman, traded in goods that were produced via the slave trade, enslaved people himself, funded and built this building with his own name on it, gave it to the city. And it's also important to note, and Reverend John Gibbons, I'm going to turn to you here, it's also important to note that actually auctions of human beings were held in vicinity of Faneuil Hall as well. I'm going to turn to you here because you're white. Pastor Copeland and Reverend Peterson have just situated this for us. As a white pastor, how are you talking to white communities who say, oh, great, so now we're just going to change the name of everything?
Sometimes Kevin has referred to me as a mercenary in this campaign, and I'll take that because I think that this is an issue that affects all people of all races, suburban communities as well as urban communities. I side with Martin Luther King, who said that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. And I would also take slight exception to your introduction, Tiziana, in saying that we would erase the name of Faneuil. We want people to know the actual history of Peter Faneuil. Yes, he was a wealthy merchant whose sole claim to fame was his wealth garnered on the backs of human beings and human trafficking. And he cited his building on the site of the first auction block for enslaved people in Boston. The building of Faneuil Hall was controversial at the time because he wanted to centralize markets in one building, and that pushed out many of the poorer vendors and allowed the wealthier merchants a space. And that continues to be the legacy of Peter Faneuil, that he has erased the history of the people that were enslaved on that very site.
So I'll turn to you, Valerie Copeland. I'm going to play a little bit of sound here from WCVB Channel 5.
Protesters staging a sit-in at City Hall in Boston. As you can see, some have been arrested hours after City Hall closed for the day. They are demanding a name change for Faneuil Hall.
So as I was preparing for today and reviewing all of the steps, starting from, you know, your first actions, Kevin Peterson, in 2017 forward, it feels, honestly, it feels striking that this much social action has made so little dent in city response. It doesn't feel like what I'm used to seeing. Can you talk about that? Because you've put yourself in these protests.
It is disheartening to have our political representatives dismiss our voices and our complaint. As citizens, as voters, as activists, as clergy, standing in the margins for justice, for equality, and all we have asked for is a conversation and a meeting. And it is hard to be in this position where we have put a lot of our physical capital, a lot of labor, planning, strategy, and work to still be in a place where we have not been able to have a meeting to discuss something that we believe is important, particularly as we've just had the celebration about the embrace, right? We cannot completely move forward without going back. And so part of this has to do with, we talk about racial reconciliation, economic reparations, it also has to do with repairing the narrative and whose voices get to be featured in history and the erasure that continues, right? And so in order to really move forward, we really need to have a conversation about what we need to reclaim from the past, what we need to repair, so that we can have, so that we can enter into the future having dealt with and remedied some of the harm that's been done.
So I want to crystallize this moment because the sound that we played, you were sitting in at City Hall into the evening looking for a meeting with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. That was on a Thursday. The following Monday was our Mondays with the Mayor. Mayor Wu sits exactly in the seat you're sitting in, Valerie, on Monday once a month. Yeah. We asked her about this. Kevin Peterson, here are pieces of what she said to us.
Unfortunately, it's not such that I have the time where someone just comes and camps out somewhere that will jump to the head of the line. We are very intentional about how to ensure that the priorities that I promise to carry out in this office are the priorities that I can help move forward. Team members have met with this group. I am briefed on every conversation that and every bit of information that is intended for me from those meetings, and it is just as effective as meeting with me directly.
So a very long no.
And it's not true.
What I was going to ask you, but do that first.
Well, it's not true. First of all, we've sent at least four different letters to the mayor, about which there could have been a response of some kind from the mayor. A form letter would and some on some level be acceptable, but there is no truth to her assertion that her team members met with us.
Okay, so she acknowledged those letters, and her assertion was that Shigun Itowu has been in conversation with you.
He walked through the protest on that evening. That was almost accidental, as he explained it. So there has been no coordination between our group and the mayor's office in terms of a sit-down as to what we're trying to do. What they have described us as trying to do is engage in symbolism that has no substance, when in fact we're talking about having substantive questions about racial inequality in the city, about which she seeks to govern fairly. And without taking in this full history of black people and the crisis that they face every day, she's not being fair. She's alluding the difficult conversations around race that materialize every day in our city. We saw on Sunday, I stood over the blood of a 13-year-old boy on Sunday in Mattapan.
We talked to Isaac Diablo yesterday about this.
There is no way for me to disconnect what I witnessed on Sunday, the blood on the ground, in 2023, disconnect that from the legacy of racism, of structural inequality, of the crisis that black people have experienced since the days of Faneuil Hall. So if Mayor Wu wants to dress this up as something that's not important or that's, that is on the margins of her concerns, that she's woefully misunderstands what black people go through every day and how it's connected to a longer history about which I believe she has no deep connection at this point.
So a couple of things there. First, mm-hmm. I think we have to acknowledge that there is a bit of a it's almost hard to keep the conversation going on the drop the mic moment of the bloody death of a 13-year-old. Yeah. And so I want to center that moment, respect it, recognize it, and I want to have a little more conversation on the thing that we're talking about, and I want to make it very clear that—
Well, I want to say that there's no disconnection, Tiziana, and no disrespect to you.
Yeah, and I'm attempting no disrespect
to you. But if you don't get, if you're not a black person, if you're not a black person, you may miss the connection that a lot of black people will make in terms of their lived reality in this city and how there is no disconnection between the first black people being brought here as slaves and the degree to which black people are treated in 2023. There's no disconnection. So although you're trying to center, and I appreciate that, we're on radio, we don't have much time, but the point that Mayor Wu is missing is that there are structural inequalities embedded in the city about which she attempts to govern without paying due deference and respect to that history. And we're trying to bring it to her attention, as we did with the last mayor, so it's not personal.
No, I mean,
but we
you,
tried to do this with Mayor Walsh. And
you didn't eat for 7 days trying
right.
to get Boston Mayor Marty Walsh to pay attention to this. Thank you for that. And I'm going to turn now back to John Gibbons for just a moment, because, again, part of this conversation is Kevin Peterson saying to me, I'm white. I may not fully understand the depth of connection of history from those moments before Faneuil Hall was built all the way to our most recent devastation in Mattapan on Sunday. That is a conversation for the white community in mm-hmm. Boston, too, who are That's the right. families that bring people to Faneuil Hall. Challenge the white community for the conversation you want the white community to have.
Absolutely. Faneuil Hall and Quincy Market remain, as has been said, an embarrassingly white space. And that is not the image that Boston would wish to project into the future. We feel that the name of Peter Faneuil chains us to a history and, as Pastor Valerie said, a narrative that is false. We would want the history of Peter Faneuil to be known in all of its ugliness, and we would hope that we have a name that would call us, beckon us into the future. And that is something that should appeal to all people, white and black, all people of color in the city of Boston and beyond.
I want to give you the last word, Reverend Peterson.
Well, only to make this point, in terms of governance for Mayor Wu, who pays attention to polls, Mass Inc. released a poll late last year, saying that 51% of all Bostonians now agree to changing the name of Faneuil Hall. She should follow the polls or have that give her a little guidance. Last point I want to make is that we would not have anything in Boston called Hitler Hall. Maybe we should make a similar analogy in terms of renaming Faneuil Hall.
That was the Reverend Kevin Peterson of the New Democracy Coalition, also Reverend John Gibbons of the Arlington Street Church of Boston, and Pastor Valerie Copeland with the Neighborhood Church of Dorchester. Yesterday, we brought you part one of a story from WBUR's podcast, Last Scene. In that part one, WBUR senior arts reporter Andrea Shea looked at the birthplace of America's candy industry in Boston's forgotten Confectioner's Row.
It was said that the aromas of these sweets filled the air with these intoxicating smells of these iconic brands, including the Necco wafer and the Charleston Chew.
Now, today, Confectioner's Row is history, but one candy maker remains, Cambridge Brands, the maker of the Charleston Chew. And in part two, Andrea Shea and her local candy guide, Susan Benjamin, bring us to the inner layer.
As the last remaining vestige of Confectioner's Row that has gone missing, Cambridge Brands is famously impenetrable. It really is like Wonka's chocolate factory. But there's a legit reason for candy companies to be secretive. Maybe you remember Slugworth, the spy trying to steal Willy Wonka's inventions? Susan says that fiction is inspired by reality, because unlike so many other inventions, candy recipes can't be patented.
If somebody walks in there and gets a hold of that formula, you're sunk, because now it is no longer your candy. It is available to anybody. And each one of those formulas are literally worth millions and millions and millions of dollars. So when you go to the door, they're not going to let you in.
Unless you're Susan Benjamin. Her charm and industry cred scores us a tour and a rare interview with the elusive woman behind the curtain at Cambridge Brands. The old white industrial building is kind of incognito. I've breezed by it countless times, never stopping to sniff, and without spotting the small sign near its entrance, it looks like a big Tootsie Roll wrapper laid flat and simply says, Cambridge Brands, a subsidiary of Tootsie Roll Industries, Inc. On the sidewalk, Susan's face changes. She looks like a little kid.
Oh, you smell it. Okay, I smell it. Thank you, Ellen Gordon.
Ellen Gordon is Tootsie Roll, Inc.'s CEO. Susan calls her the grand dame of the candy universe. She's only seen the notoriously media-shy executive from a distance at industry expos. But Susan has never had a chance to speak with Mrs. Gordon. The company's head of security lets us in and escorts us to a small room. Other friendly gatekeepers introduce themselves.
We need to get you signed in over here.
Sure. Wow. So we're going to have you signing some paperwork.
We're given some lengthy confidentiality forms. I can't remember signing anything like them in all my years as a journalist. Susan's not surprised.
I mean, the fact we got this far from many places is pretty amazing.
We're running everything today, so...
Wow.
Today we're in, we've got Charleston Chew getting made on the fifth floor. The fourth floor, we're running our sugar babies.
Yes.
The third floor,
that's so
we're running our...
This is production manager Richard Neal. He used to work for Nestle and says if that company owned this facility, it would have moved production out west years ago. But it seems CEO Ellen Gordon plays the candy game her own way.
Hi, Mrs. Gordon.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm going to take them into the large conference room, okay?
She's known to be very charming, family-oriented, and oriented toward employees.
As Susan whispers some background on this real-life Wonka, she reminds me how big this is. Mrs. Gordon almost never gives interviews. In the conference room, a spread of muffins and fruit is laid out on the table. The soft-spoken CEO sits down and pours some tea. She reminds me of my grandmother, if my grandmother ran a multi-billion-dollar company. She wears a smart black suit and a cute Tootsie Roll pendant around her neck. This 90-year-old has known that chocolate taffy her whole life. Her grandfather and parents ran Tootsie Roll Inc. for decades.
What was it like as a child? Were you like running around in Candy Factory? It just sounds like a dream come true. You were a kid in a candy shop.
Yes. I grew up in the Candy Factory in the sense that on weekends, the biggest treat was to be able to go with my father to work and to go to the factory.
Gordon's family bought initial shares of Tootsie Roll stock when the company went public in 1918. They've maintained majority ownership since the 30s. She became CEO in 2015, making Gordon the second female president to lead a New York Stock Exchange company. She remembers riding a lot of freight elevators as a kid. Now it's our turn.
I'm having my Willy Wonka moment.
One staff member jokes we won't see any Oompa Loompas on this tour.
This is the fifth floor, our Charleston Chew department. All of the Charleston Chews in the world are made here. We have a nougat kitchen.
And yes, it smells amazing. We're given hairnets and walk past vats of egg solution being mixed with a slurry of corn syrup and liquid sugar. Then it gets blown through a network of pipes.
So if you look up there, he's evacuating the nougat from the blender.
I'm told this production line makes like 5 million pounds of nougat a year. Mrs. Gordon still gets excited watching the sticky white mass being transformed.
It's like spread out over belts, but it's all one great big mass. And then come the cutters, which slice it so that it's in strips.
Those cutters are called guillotines, and the candy industry itself is pretty cutthroat. The Charleston Chew actually reveals something about why Cambridge Brands is the last major candy manufacturer in Cambridge. The Chew didn't always belong to Tootsie Roll Inc., but it has been made in this very building since the early 1920s. Gordon's family chased the Charleston Chew for decades, and finally, in the 1990s, snatched it up, along with a few other classic brands. It's part of an ongoing story of consolidation in the candy industry.
And that's how Junior Mints, Charleston Chew, Sugar Babies, and Sugar Daddies became a part of Tootsie Roll Industries.
Mr. Owl, how many licks does it take to get to the Tootsie Roll center of a Tootsie Pop?
A good question. Let's find out. One, two, three.
But here's a question I'm still grappling with. Even with the rise of science and biotech in Cambridge and the usual jockeying for real estate that happens in cities like this, why did Confectioners Row go missing? After all, candy is still a whopper of an industry. Susan says the rise of conglomerates and their ability to produce and distribute products on a mass scale across the country gobbled up the little guys along Confectioner's Row. But for Susan, Tootsie is different. Sure, it earned more than $500 million in 2021, but it's been owned by the same candy family for almost a century.
Some of our brands go back to the 19th century, and while the process can change, you even have to make sure as you change the process that it doesn't change the texture or the taste, because the consumers are very smart. They sense it. They taste it.
That happened when new machinery smoothed out the little dimple you feel with your tongue on the bottom of a Junior Mint. Susan loves that story.
People were outraged. This is not the Junior Mint. Where is the dimple? So they went back. They got new machinery, and they put the dimple back in because that's how much it mattered.
While Cambridge Brands develops new candies and variations, like the Mini Chews, Gordon says they never mess with the classic logos and wrappers. People are attached, and striking a balance is a delicate dance.
Our lives change. Our styles changed. And what do we do to keep in style and make it awesome and cool today, what was awesome and cool a long time ago to make sure you're relevant.
I think that's both a question and an answer to our mystery about Cambridge brand survival. And you know, smacking a frozen Charleston Chew Bar on a counter is extra cool to me now because it's essentially a humble, edible vestige of lost Confectioner's Row. But there's something else both Mrs. Gordon and Susan seem to get, that deep down, candy makes people feel good, maybe even like little kids again.
There is that attachment that all of us have. Even people who claim not to like candy, they do. I'm telling you, they do.
And Ellen Gordon never grows tired of walking through her candy factory. As for all the protective secrecy shrouding Cambridge brands, the CEO smiles and says, yep, it's real. And it also makes a good story.
If anybody says to me, well, what do you do? And I say, I work in a candy company. Invariably, they smile.
In 2022, Cambridge Brands installed a new mural to commemorate the lost history of Confectioner's Row. So now it'll be a little less forgotten. And I got to see it in person, which was pretty sweet.
Yeah, so it goes all the way from, you know, early 1800s to 2022. Cambridge Brands at 810 Main Street is the longest continuously operating candy manufacturer in Cambridge and the last remaining candy manufacturing plant from the original heyday of candy making. If the wind is blowing in your direction, you can smell the sweet treats of Junior Mint Sugar Babies, Charleston Chews, Junior Caramels, Tootsie Mini Bites, and Fruit Chew Mini Bites coming to life. Oh, and there's a picture of the little owl, the Tootsie Roll owl.
One, two, three, three.
That was Andrea Shea and Nora Sachs with The Lost History of Confectioner's Row, an episode from WBUR's podcast Last Seen. To hear more WBUR podcasts, go to wbur.org/podcasts. And now, Brilliant Boston. Massachusetts has more than 100 institutions of higher education, and there are professors bending the brains of students in every single one of them, like Terrence Johnson, a professor of African American Religious Studies at Harvard Divinity School. This semester, Johnson is teaching for the first time a class called Existence Behind the Veil. It's a deep dive into Black identity and spirituality, and the class reexamines what it means to be human and how we do and don't grant others humanity. Terrence Johnson is here with us in Studio 2. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So there's like five different questions I wanted to ask you right off the top.
Okay.
And I had planned to ask one, but I'm going to ask a different one.
Okay.
What's the veil? When we say experience behind the veil, what does that mean?
Sure. It's a concept developed by W.B. Du Bois back in 1903 in the Souls of Black Folk. And he argues that we have for so long in America ignored a group of people, and that these people he calls African Americans or the Negro live behind a veil. And this veil actually really blurs our vision of these people. And he eventually argues that because of that, we've created worlds in which we don't even know that exist behind the veil, and that these people are, in fact, the problem, like the Negro problem. And so he's trying to complicate in the Souls of Black Folk the ways in which we look at African Americans and say, look, you can't actually even understand them because you only see them partly, in part because of the veil.
So it's not, it's like an inability to even see fully.
Yes.
Another
yes,
person.
Yes. In part because of all the preconditions that we bring to the table when we actually approach the other. So part of the starting point that I'm trying to argue in the course is that we as social creatures come to the table with rich traditions, rich habits, but we have to figure out a way, how do we displace those traditions momentarily as we engage difference?
All right. So there's a lot in there. And I think I want to start with this idea of rich traditions, right? Because in reading some of the material to get ready for today, some of the things you've written and some of the readings from the class, these rich traditions have been exclusive of others' humanity, if I might. Is that fair?
Yeah. So, you know, Du Bois starts off in the Souls of Black Folk with this idea, look, dear reader, I want to open up a world to you and show the human sorrow, the human passion, the religion and its meaning of a people. And so in part, the course is trying to argue that, look, for so long we've looked at African Americans as the problem, right? As slaves who've come here, and now we have to deal with these people once they're emancipated. And all these social structures have been designed then not to necessarily help them acclimate to society, but to, in other words, to keep them reinforced as slaves in a different form, but slave nonetheless, according to contemporary writings in Afro-pessimism.
All right. So I'm going to take a pause there. I'm going to give us a little context, and we're going to come back to
okay.
that. All right. So the pause is, so you're teaching a class. These are graduate students,
yes.
right, at Harvard Divinity School, which has been around since the early 1800s,
yes.
right, since the time of situation that the veil refers to, right, when we were establishing those rich traditions
yes, yes.
of otherness and Black people in America as the problem to be solved. So today, students who are coming into this class, students who are taking a degree that this is a part of, what are they studying for? Who do they want to go out in the world and be?
I mean, we have a range of incredible students. I would say a number come in who want to become professors. They want to teach religion, teach scripture, right, engage the academic world. Then we have another portion of students who want to become ministers in some form, either an imam or work with, you know, a synagogue or with a traditional church. Then we also have a group of people who simply want to have an experience. They're, you know, really smart, really engaging students. Some of them are artists, some of them are dancers, and they want to come actually explore these perennial issues around how does God affect my life? How do we understand God in a pluralistic world?
All right. So with that in mind and understanding that for our listeners, right, I'm thinking about some are dancers, some are artists, some are professors, some are pastors, some are in banking, some are lawyers, some are teachers. Where is God in this conversation about a history of dehumanizing Black people in America? Setting up systems that were designed to treat Black people as the problem. Sure. And the struggle, the modern struggle today, to undo those systems for full American participation for everyone.
I mean, it's a tough question. I would argue, on one hand, God is absent. And yet, what is the source of our dehumanization has been the ways in which we've used religion, right, to justify our particularity, particularly the particularity of a handful of white slave owners, right? And I've argued that we've used aspects of religion, right, and aspects of politics, and with that kind of, right, collision, we've created the fragments then to justify, right, through laws, through cultures, through practices, why we should dehumanize this particular group of people. So it becomes normal to assume that Blacks are criminal. And so I would argue that God is absent from that, but then we use a theology that we've created to justify our own existence. Otherwise, people will begin to question, well, wait a minute, why are we treating these people in this ill way and not others? But it's easy, say, to condemn the trans person or the gay or lesbian person if our theology says, oh, they're condemned to hell. So we can sit comfortably knowing, oh, our behavior is correct because this is what the will of God dictates.
We're talking with Terrence Johnson, who's a professor of African-American religious studies at Harvard Divinity School. It's Brilliant Boston, where we dive into these, you know, mind-bending courses that students all around our community are taking. You're teaching this new one called Existence Behind the Veil. You just talked about, you know, a collision that creates pieces of discrimination, pieces of pain, pieces of dehumanization. And you said there's no God in that, but we've used religion, we've sort of structured our religious teaching to then justify what we've been doing. It is fascinating, not for you to sit here as a professor and say that, but as a pastor, which you also are. You're an itinerant pastor in the AME Church. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, itinerant elder. So I have not pastored officially, but I have worked as an assistant and associate minister.
Thank you. And I thank you for that clarification because it's one I don't know. It, for you to occupy that space and say there's no God in this, right? So if somebody's taking this conversation that we're having and struggling with it later, where does one then turn to faith, especially Judeo-Christian faith, if we've set up a set of religious teachings that say, you know, that you say God is absent from?
I mean, this is why I think it's so important just to read history and to engage the world, because I would argue that through Black theology, we understand that we all have starting points in terms of how we engage scripture. And for African Americans, right, our starting point has been, we were told, okay, your reward is in heaven. But there was something that happened with among the slaves that said, no, we actually believe that there's a different promise. We believe that if Yahweh can free the children of Israel, God can free us. And so we believe in a promise. And so we engage the text not through this hierarchy in terms of the church gives us these doctrines, but based on the lived experience of African Americans that then engages scripture. And the assumption is that God has promised freedom. So it is our duty then to engage and to have faith, but to work for our freedom through our acts and through our faith.
Tell me about the students in class who are struggling with these concepts and trying to take them in your classroom.
I mean, they're an amazing group of students. I mean, all backgrounds, really fascinating. And I would say what they're struggling with is this idea of how do you have hope, right, when you see someone murdered on television, right? We talked about this idea recently of George Floyd's cry. And I'm like, we have not as a public really dissected what that cry meant for someone to cry out for your dead mother. And then it beckons the world to protest. That becomes the ways in which God can intercede within all the mist, all the rubble. And people can say, I don't know this person, but I hear the cry, and then people responded. And that's what we're trying. That's what we're wrestling with. How then do you take that cry and recognize that it's real? It's based on an unjustified death and murder, and yet there's still potential for hope in the cry.
How?
How? Because it galvanized the world to say this is actually wrong and it's evil. And now we then have to use that to further our movements and to further our behavior, not only in public life, right, but also in terms of the workplace and in the classroom.
So there's this interesting intersection that you're talking about, which is sort of the teaching of God, the teaching of theology, the teaching of Judeo-Christian traditions, the acts every day on the street of protest, of rejection of the systems that we're facing, the individual pain and experiences of personal lives. And in the case of George Floyd, a horrible one that was captured through social media and brought forward, right? How do you teach people basic frameworks to take that in every day? And let me give you my point. When you said that the public cry, when you said watching people die on TV, you went back to 2020. I thought you were going to go back to last month.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to go back to Terrence Nichols.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You could have gone back just 1 month.
And he also cried out for his mother
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, which is why I thought you were going to go to Tyre Nichols. And I apologize for the Terrence Nichols. When we talked about Tyre Nichols, we did a whole hour with a pastor, state legislator, and a head of a local nonprofit organization where we looked at Tyre Nichols and Tyler Lawrence, who was killed. In fact, earlier in the show, we heard Reverend Kevin Peterson make a reference to it when we were having the Faneuil Hall conversation. He was killed the following weekend in Mattapan. So this could have been last month. What are the tools that you teach students who want to be pastoral supports for others, who want to be teachers for others, right? What are the tools you can teach us to carry so that in that moment when we're overwhelmed with the pain of it, we can also reach into that toolbox and say, I know what I've got to help me make sense of what just happened.
Sure. I want to sit with my Afro-pessimist colleagues and say, look, we have to sit in the pain. We have to sit in the blood and recognize that the very possibility of having clarity may not happen. But as folk who are interested in pastoral care, we have to sit there and know that we're not trying necessarily to resolve, but we're trying to engage. So part of the framework has everything to do with what is your starting point, right? What text are you bringing to the conversation in order to engage what happened? We can't ignore, but we have to actually look and sit with it. And that's the part where I think as Americans, particularly as non-Black folk, we don't want to sit with that pain, right? We want to move to legislation, move through protest, but we don't want to sit with the pain because part of what I'm trying to teach through the class is that that's the pain that people walk with every day in life. But yet we wear the mask, as Paul Dunbar says, and we smile when we actually want to cry. And it's that kind of doubleness that we've used to penetrate the world. And yet I want to say, okay, can we use that doubleness, right, as a construct for examining how we all have these competing identities, some are very different, and yet how do we use that then to push beyond them, right? Recognizing that we're trapped, but what it means to be human is to push beyond and to press against the boundaries that keep us enclosed to what is familiar. And that's, to me, the tragic beauty of Black theology and of Black religion in general.
You know, there's this term you've used, and we're speaking with Terrence Johnson of the Harvard Divinity School. There's this term you've used a few times, Afro-pessimism, which seems like a pretty academic term. But I'm guessing that there's an accessible way to explain what you mean by that.
Oh, yes. And people on the ground are reading Afro-pessimism. And basically, it's this notion, it's a descriptive take on what's happening to Black folk, right, prior to enslaving the U.S. Basically, that the U.S. is dependent upon Black death. So this idea that we see Black bodies and brown bodies killed, and we watch them on videos, and we rehearse this kind of ritual of crying, they argue our nation depends upon that, and that there is no freedom for Black folk in this country, given the fact that we are not viewed as human.
All right, so those are the two things I want to unpack now in our conversation. And again, the goal with these Brilliant Bostons is to let our brains be bent by professors who are bringing these concepts into classrooms. We can't take every class, and we can't always, we don't always get a chance to engage this way. So there are two pieces to this that I want to break down. The first is this idea that the U.S. is dependent upon Black death. That argues that our very existence as a country, and you can imagine, I can hear the cacophony of various responses from listeners to that assertion right in my head, that the very existence of the country relies on, is based in, and needs, I think you're saying, Black death.
When you saw Tyrese Nichols' family at the address on Capitol Hill with the president, right, everyone stood to applaud the fact that these people had lost their sons. Why do we applaud and then not actually deal with the very root of the problem in terms of Black criminality, in terms of access to guns? And yet every time there's a mass shooting, there's a ritual. And yet I think our existence now, we assume that it's natural, it's normal, it's what we expect, and we ritualize it, but we don't actually deconstruct it and try to solve the problem. And so that's what Afro-pessimists are saying. Look, we are so dependent upon hope, and always trying to say Black folk are resilient, right? They have great hope. They're always persevering. And they're saying it's all a myth, because even if five people become successful, or even if we elect the first Black president, what happens? We have a rebellion on Capitol Hill, insurrection, because people think that we're trying to displace them, right? In Charlottesville, they said, Blacks and Jews will not replace us. And Afro-pessimists, they want us to sit and say, that's the reality we face, even as we smile, even as we become corporate heads, presidents of universities, that the reality is people assume we are displacing them, and we have to sit with that.
So I'm assuming then that you would situate, I'm thinking of Morning Edition this morning on public radio, where they discussed moves in the state of Florida by the Florida legislature to take several steps so that, for example, intersectionality could no longer be taught in the schools. And I'm shorthanding this, right? Legislation is complex. I'm shorthanding. But intersectionality being the various clashes or intersections of identity that could, like, so I might be, I might experience gender discrimination because I'm a woman, but I'm white, right? Versus a Black woman who's experiencing racial discrimination and gender discrimination, and the unique intersection of those two things. So I imagine in the context of pushes around the country to step back from what we're teaching about the Black experience, about lived Black lives, you must have a position on that from this Afro-pessimism angle that takes us all the way back to, as you say, you know, 1700s here in America, that reclaiming of an old space. Is that fair?
That's a fair assessment. And then I come back and say, but what about the Andrea Coopers of the world? What about the Du Boises of the world? To come back and say, how then do we challenge? In other words, there's an assumption that when we bring in new resources into the classroom, it's about displacement. New resources allow us to critically engage in new ways. So when I was at Morehouse College, we were reading Shakespeare, but Dr. Stevens also brought in Billie Holiday to complete, to show how the tragic nature of life, it's also in these other iterations. So bringing in new information, intersectionality is about how do we expand the very possibility of what it means to be human, but also how do we engage this knowledge in a way that allows us to push the very grounds of who we are.
So what is the potential then of having a broader audience understand this idea that we are constructed? It's funny. These are new terms for me, right? These are new concepts for me. And so it's hard to just sort of summarize and feed them back to you, right? Because my brain's going, I'm bending as we're talking. But this idea that we have created a systemic dehumanization of our Black neighbors, of our black brothers and sisters in the country, that we have relied on the existence of and narratives about black death, but that we could bring new frameworks in. What's the potential for better shared understanding? Where is the hope, especially as both a professor and a pastor, as you teach us about this?
I think the hope is in the very possibility in terms of the human condition. And the human condition is always possible because we're always engaging each other. Except we choose then to limit those engagements based on presuppositions, based on lies. And so part of what we try to do is say, look, we want to engage the world like we would engage a text, right? When you read literature, you're open to the possibility of the characters. But in the real life experiences, we're not open to those possibilities. We come in.
We're more open to what we read in a book than we are to what we could find in each other.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, you said it beautifully.
Talk about bam, right?
You said it beautifully.
Bam. There's the brain bend. I'm sorry. Please pick that thread up. Keep going.
No. And so part of how reading black theology, for example, people say, oh, that's identity politics. No, we're actually expanding what it means to be human because we're bringing in new resources, not to displace, but to trouble the water, as it were. And as people who are people of faith, right, we are told to be troubled. In other words, we are not to be of this world. We're to engage it, but recognize we have limits. And that's part of the problem is that we've put our hope. Now, Angela, there's an artist who talks about this idea of everyone wants a slice of the devil's pie. We assume that we can criticize capitalism, right? We can be so woke, and yet we still want a piece of that pie. And part of what I want to argue is that what black religion does for us, it acknowledges, right, that when you want that pie, you are also complicit in the very problem, right, that we're trying to dismantle. So the fact that you choose not to engage, what does the person mean by wokeness? They choose that you choose only one source to confirm who you are and confirm the belief that that's actually correct, current debates on wokeness, that means you're choosing to believe in a lie.
So this idea, if people listening today come away troubled by what they're hearing you say, troubled by the assumptions that you're challenging, that's a healthy part of the spiritual journey, it sounds
yes.
like.
And a healthy part of black preaching, but also a part of black music, right? Black gospel music, we want to trouble the water, right? We want to push you so that you're not comfortable where you are because, again, you're always striving toward whatever that end mark is, whether it's a good life, right? Whether it's to see your family thrive. I mean, that's what we're trying to teach, that you're striving towards a certain, not necessarily perfection, but striving towards something that's more complicated than the traditions you were born with.
You love teaching this, don't you?
Oh, I love it.
Why?
It's so life-giving. It's what I grew up with. And I'm so grateful for my teachers at Morehouse because this is what they taught. They're like, we want you to go out and change the world with this literature. You don't have to displace people to bring in new resources. And it's actually then life-giving because you find your voice in this material. And Toni Morrison says, look, you find your voice not by trying to say you're better, but by speaking your truth and allowing that truth then to become universal.
Terrence Johnson is a professor of African American Religious Studies at Harvard Divinity School. The new course is called Existence Behind the Veil. We got just a taste of it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.